Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and work of Flannery O'Connor. Born in Georgia in 1925, O'Connor wrote prolifically before her early death at age 39 due to lupus. She routinely wrote every morning until noon, and spent her afternoons and evenings tending to her domestic birds or entertaining visitors. Informed by the community surrounding her Georgia hometown and her Catholic faith, O'Connor's short fiction is rich with complex anti-heroes and ironic moral turns. "I write," she said, "because I don't know what to think until I read what I say." O'Connor wrote two novels, Wise Blood and The Violent Barrett Away, and two short story collections, A Good Man is Hard to Find, and Everything That Rises Must Converge. Her complete stories, published posthumously in 1972, won the National Book Award that year. In 1988, the Library of America published her collected works. She was the first post-war writer to be so honored. She lived most of her adult life on her family's ancestral farm, Andalusia, outside Milledgeville, Georgia. For this episode, we are joined by Cassie Minnell, curator at Andalusia, the home of Flannery O'Connor. You can learn more about Cassie and their work in the episode description. Cassie is interviewed by Nate King, content and exhibits manager at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place March 21st, 2025, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Cassie, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm looking forward to talking about Flannery O'Connor with you during this year, her centennial year. But first, before we get into that, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves and your relation to O'Connor's work?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on. My name is Cassie Minnell. I'm the curator at Andalusia, the home of Flannery O'Connor here in Milledgeville, Georgia. My relation to O'Connor is that I, you know, sort of help preserve her legacy through her house and the material culture she left behind.
That's great. Can you tell me a little bit more about that work? What sort of archives are you preserving? What sort of programs do you do?
So we maintain her farmhouse that she lived in for the last 13 years of her life, from 1951 to 1964. The property that we maintain is around 100 acres that consists of her home. So originally an 1850s farmhouse that has been expanded upon. And then the outbuildings such as various barns, workers' houses. We do kind of continue on her legacy. We do have two peacocks here, as well as our interpretive center, which is a brand new addition, 2023, and which sort of maintains her, which allows us to maintain her collections and also put on yearly exhibits. And we have, when it comes to what we have, our archives, we kind of have everything to some extent. We have books, clothing, dishware, shoes, furniture, bedding, household goods such as like perfumes, bath soaps, dish soaps, toilet paper, bank records, receipts. So lots of photographs that we maintain. So really there's a little bit of everything.
Yeah, that's quite impressive. Well, yeah, especially all the little ephemera. That's I always liked those in author homes. So you kind of get a sense of how this writer lived day to day, which is fascinating.
Exactly.
Yeah,
like I can tell you definitively what brand of like instant coffee they bought because we have it.
Right. Well, let's hear it. What
it's kind? Folgers.
Nice.
I don't know if you're a no free sponsorships kind of no free promo kind of podcast, but
yeah, now maybe we will. Yeah, that's the day to day aspect is interesting, especially for a writer. With writers in general, often a ritual is so important, right? Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about what Flannery O'Connor did, you know, on a day to day basis, and how that impacted her writing?
Yeah, of course. She was an extremely rigid. Oh, that sounds so mean. But she lived really very firmly on a schedule where she got up every single morning, attended mass first thing, 7 a.m. at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in downtown Milledgeville. Then she would come back and write for 3 hours. That was kind of her natural state, was 3 hours, 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., 9 to noon. Then she would break for lunch. She either had it in the farmhouse, or she would go downtown. Some of her favorite restaurants were downtown. And then she would return in the afternoon. That was when she would, hosts guests, do she did a lot of lecture circuits. That would be when she would do things like paint or read or care for her birds, be done in the evening. And then she would go to bed relatively early because, again, she had to be up, first thing to get to 7 a.m. mass.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And the ritual of mass also, and every day, and then writing. In your research and studies and reading of her work and letters, is there any relation to a way in which her religious practice sort of set her up to then write afterwards? Or, is there a relation in that sense?
I mean, I would say there's a lot of relationship between her religion and her stories and like the morals and the way that she talked about them, and just her outlook on the world is so based in Catholicism, and then is so that is then translated to her fiction. As for setting it up as well, there's a published work of her prayer journal, which she wrote, as a young adult, basically like writing to God, being like, I want to be an author. I want to be a writer. I think this is what you're calling me to do. Please, please let me do this. Like, let me do this thing that I think you're setting me up to do. You can't kind of talk about one without the other. They're very, very intertwined. I mean, you can look at it just very directly, but they are extremely intertwined in her worldly outlook, how she approached it, and sort of some messages that she kind of wanted you to take away. A religion and false religion is also kind of a big theme in her stories. Like one of her most famous short stories, Good Country People, features a Bible salesman who later reveals that he does not actually believe in God. And in this book, a briefcase that he's carrying Bibles, they're like hollowed out and have like flasks inside of them. So,
Interesting, yeah. Was her Catholicism started from a young age? Like, did she grow up in Catholicism? How did she come to that religion?
she grew up in it. Her parents were Catholic. They came from a long line of Catholics. In fact, her great grandfather, a man by the name of Hugh Traynor, this is a great grandfather on her mother's side, actually founded the Catholic Church here in Milledgeville in the 1840s. They were founded in his apartments. And I believe another cousin, like a couple generations later, actually helped fund the purchase of the land the church now sits on. So very, very closely tied. And in fact, her parents' home was right across the street, from one of the major cathedrals in Savannah. So she was essentially like the childhood home she lived at from infancy to the age of 13. She kind of grew up in the view of the Catholic Church. So it was always there for her.
Yeah, that yeah. How do you avoid it in that scenario? Yeah, especially when it runs so deep in your family too. That's fascinating. And another interesting aspect about O'Connor to me has always been understanding her relationship to Catholicism and how that comes through her writing. And yet, she seems to be widely popular and read by many different denominations, right? It's like you said, her religion sort of informed her work, but it doesn't necessarily, like, I don't know if dictate her work is the right word, or so I'm curious, what do you think about her writing makes it so impactful to a lot of different kind of people?
I think it's because it feel well, it's exaggerated. It feels very grounded, especially to people who do have some connection to the South. And it's definitely not to just people who have connections to the South. We have people who come through who are fans from, all over the world who felt really connected to her. Some of our social media, like the biggest audience outside of like the continental United States or like the United States in general, is like Italy. So we have a lot of people from around the world. And I think it's that so much of it feels very true and very grounded, even in these like dramatic ways. You can see the relationships, they're so specific. And I think she helped shape a genre around her that I think also consists of it. Like, you can't really talk about the concept of Southern Gothic literature or even Gothic literature kind of as a whole without mentioning her as one of like the pillars of it, because she helps sort of shape her and Faulkner and McCullers kind of help shape how we process and like how we talk about this. And Southern Gothic talks a lot about class structures and racism and things that a lot of people can think about and relate to, even if they're not in, you know, the American South.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm glad you mentioned her stature in that genre of Southern mm-hmm. Gothic, because yeah, she's huge. And
hated the term, it's very funny that we're like, no, we kind of retroactively slapped that label onto her. She always called herself a grotesque, not a gothic author, but unfortunately Southern grotesque is not really a genre and Southern Gothic is, so we got to slap that label on it, even if she herself probably would not have called herself Southern Gothic.
What about that did she have issue with? Do you know?
I would have to double check the exact quote, but I think she just didn't feel like it fit well.
Yeah.
And maybe that was because she was a fan of some of the like earlier gothics, like Henry James, who falls a little bit closer into like the traditional, you would imagine, European gothic style. She was such a big fan of him that maybe she didn't like enjoy the comparison. Though I guess if an author I loved, you know, was like directly compared to, you know, like genre wise to my work, I'd be like, well, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. And I'm glad you also mentioned some of the themes of Southern Gothic literature, and wonder if you could expand on those and how O'Connor wrote about them and covered them.
Yeah. So the ones she writes about a lot are sort of interfamilial dynamics, the dynamics of somewhat religions, like again, in specifically some of her short stories, and her novel Wise Blood plays a lot with that. You know, people pretending to be more righteous than they are. She talks about sort of class, like there'll often be struggles between the people who are, you know, farm owners versus farm workers. A lot of her characters are, you know, sort of, they're farm workers, they're transient, either because they're transient because they are doing crime, or they're transient because of economic circumstance. And then there's several, her relationship to race is very complicated in her literature, but there is more than one story that attempts to like talk about racism to some extent. There is one story of a man who's sitting on a bus with his mother, who is racist, and he thinks he's so like above this, like he's like, I'm, you know, so much better than my mother, you know, da, 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 da. And then his mother ends up getting along better with the you know, other patrons on the bus who are African American than he does. Or there's one revelation, which is one of her later stories, where a woman, you know, she thinks she's so much better than everyone else. She, you know, she's racist, she's homophobe, she's a bigot, and all sort of all varietals. And she has a heart attack and is like looking up at heaven and seeing these people in front of her who are, you know, who are Black people, who are homosexuals, who are, you know, people that she would deem lesser than, who are entering heaven before her. She is kind of stuck on the ground. So, well, there's a lot of complicated things to say, and we'll never totally know 100% of her views on race. There are some hints that like she was working through it and was trying to be more progressive than some of her contemporaries, though, again, obviously she used a lot of extremely harsh language, a lot of slurs, and that is deeply uncomfortable for a lot of people.
Yes, totally. And mentioning that, yeah, you've seen her evolution in her writing, or has she, as you said, working through those things? It's an interesting thing too, because, you know, she's born in 1925, but only lives, what is it, 39 years?
Yeah, old? She dies at the age of 39 in 1964. So really cut off extremely young.
Yeah.
So we can talk about the fact that, you know, the letters we have, there was a lot of sort of culling and choosing what was appropriate. And then also there was this sort of abrupt stop that we don't know what she would have evolved into, you know, if she had been allowed to continue that growth, continue to write, continue to explore, where would she have ended up now? I fully believe that there's a possibility she could have lived this long had she not had lupus. Her own mother lived to be 99. Her first cousin lived to be 97. She has another first cousin alive who's in her 90s, another in his 80s. So I think it's very possible she could have lived quite a long time. She could still be with us today, you know, if she had not had lupus. So I think we
And
don't
it
know what she would have been.
right. And it's interesting because, you know, it's still such an impactful writer in the course of history, you know, American history and American literature, and just imagine the body of work if not cut short by lupus.
She did a majority of her 31 short stories in the 13 years that she was living down here at Andalusia and finished up both of her novels down here. So she did a huge some of them she published a little bit earlier while she was in graduate school, but a majority of the body of her work was between 1945 and 1964. So, very slim period of time. So if she had just kept tricking out work at that pace, she'd probably be like this. She would, I don't know if she'd rival like a Patterson or something, but she'd be up there in sheer amount of published work.
That's a fine point. And it's making me think too, now that we're talking about, like, you know, as you mentioned, you know, she maybe would still be alive. And but it, you know, unfortunately that's not the case. But what do you, if she were alive, how do you think, you know, do you think she'd be actively writing? Do you think she would have
Oh yeah.
engaged in
Oh
other
yeah. Oh
newer
yeah.
media?
Absolutely. Absolutely. She was not going to retire. I guarantee you, she would write, even if she not had lupus, she was still alive, she'd still be writing. She would write until like literally the Lord took her, because she did essentially like she tucked her drafts, even when she was going to the hospital for her final days, she tucked drafts underneath her pillow with the intention of coming back to them. So like dying was probably the only thing that would have stopped her from writing.
Do you think she would have engaged in any newer media like film or TV or even social media, you know?
That's a fun question that I sometimes debate with people. I don't know. I feel like she might have loosened up her copyright restrictions. I think she still would have been very limited on like what she would have let people adapt. I don't think she would have switched to writing for TV or writing for film. I think she would have been just as protective of her copyright. Social media, that's a fun one for me. She's a very opinionated person, so part of me thinks she'd like using social media because she did like to debate with people. So I think there is a possibility that she would like to be on social media just to debate people. And I think, but I don't think she would use it. I don't think she would be very active on it. Even with her love of debating people, I don't think she'd use it that much. I think she possibly would have like a Finsta for her birds, because she did really, really love all of her birds. So I think she might have like a bird-based Instagram, and that's it. Like that's she wouldn't use it for anything else. She would just post pictures of her birds, not that frequently, and that would be it. That would be the only social media she even routinely
I would love to follow that. Yeah, that'd be great.
engaged
That is an interesting, maybe we can talk about the birds a little bit,
in.
because that it is, like you said, it actually was rather important and part of her daily routine too. So yeah,
Yes.
and I love that you have, you said two
Peacocks.
peacocks.
We have two of them, Aster and Mrs. Shortley, named after characters from The Displaced Person. So Flannery loved birds. In her time here at her largest, she had over 100 pet birds,
100
over
pet
40 of
birds.
which were peafowl, so peacocks and peahens. But she also had ducks, geese, swans, chickens, pheasant, quail, all various times, various amounts. You know, she loved birds. I don't. She would actually feed them out of like a tin can that she'd walk around the property with, and they'd like come up and feed, or she'd throw them. just loved birds since birth. I mean, then, you know, there's some people who are like dog people, some people who are cat people. She's absolutely like a bird person. When she was a child, she taught a chicken to walk backwards. And that was like her first sort of brush with fame was when that chicken walked backwards. Her one of her cousins, a woman by the name of Katie Sims, actually called the news and had them come and like film it.
That's
Though
so
it
funny.
actually, the video, which you can still find on YouTube, is actually of a chicken walking forward, played in reverse, because it actually got stage fright one do it day of. But she still counted that as one of her greatest achievements. But it was also little things like in a home ec or home ec adjacent class in school, they were told to make an outfit, like probably the implication thinking it was going to be for a doll or for themselves. But she made one for a chicken.
That's funny.
So just little things like that. One of her essays she wrote is called King of the Birds, and it's entirely about peacocks. So it just sort of became an influence on her, and there were so many of them that they sort of, especially the peacock, kind of became like a symbol of her. Like it's sort of an image that people associate with her is the peacock.
Yeah, certainly. I feel like it's on a lot of book covers of her story collections.
She talked about him a lot too in letters and like various things that they would do. And she compared herself to birds sometimes. At one point, she compares herself to a one-eyed swan, saying like both of them, the very, very loose summary was like both of them, they have to go about their business, him with his disability, me with mine. So she would compare herself to birds quite often. And then peacocks, I think, took the forefront, A, because she had the most of them. They're also very, how do I say this nicely, noticeable. No, they are a lot. They're very loud and they're very colorful and they're very bright. And there are stories of them getting across the street and chasing people around parking lots because a lot of her birds were free roam for at least a portion of the day. So
That's funny. And it sounds fun and like it's interesting because I feel like there's a lot of humor in her writing as well.
Oh, she's very funny.
Yeah, like was she like that in person too? Like just
I mean,
existing through the world?
I think her letters are hilarious, and a lot of people did think she was funny. She's very blunt. So if you don't find that sort of thing funny, you wouldn't find her funny. But a lot of, I mean, like her friends thought she was funny. Her goal with her writing was to be funny. Or I think her goal was to be funny. And I don't think she'd be offended like if people like found her funny.
Yeah. I mean, like one, and it's maybe a dark funny, but one quote that I quite like is it's from A Good Man Is Hard to Find. And it's the misfit talking. He said, "She would have been a good woman," the misfit said, "if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life."
Yeah,
So
that's
that's,
the sort of darkly funny thing, or just other forms of humor, like her talking about some like a school teacher had brought it by the farm, and he was, goes, and this is a donkey, and this is a peacock, and this is Miss Flannery, who's an author. And so like the full quote goes, so the kids have gone home seeing a donkey and a chicken and a peacock and an author.
That's funny. Yeah, wow.
So that's sort of the humor she's bringing to the situation.
Do you get a lot of, I'm guessing a lot of students at student groups?
Fair amounts. Most of our school groups tend to be on the older side. Like we get a lot of high schoolers.
That makes sense.
We've gotten a couple of younger kids, but eighth grade is usually the youngest age that we get in terms of our field trips, just because we're
How do you present Flannery O'Connor? Perhaps the teacher at this point has already done it, but like, yeah, how would you to a young person today, how would you say you should read this work or why?
I guess it depends on how young we're talking. Because
True.
if we're talking like little kids, I hand them one of the like chill we talk about the little children's biographies that exist. But for high schoolers, we talk and generally for everyone, our tour and our museum, we touch on the literature because we can't, but you can't avoid talking about it. Like why otherwise it'd be just like why this house? You
Yeah.
know? But it's also, you know, we talk about the who she was as a person and like what her life was like here. And that doesn't really change from her from the ages. We might, you know, touch on different subjects, maybe like talk a little bit more about something in one room than we do in another. But overall, our tours, I would say, are the same. And we focus on her life and we answer questions as they come. But for older kids, we start like, you know, if people talk about literature, you can compare it to them. I know some people, again, I've seen this more online than in person, where they saw the Maya Hawke movie and they were like, yeah, that like that was a kind of an entry point into it. Or talking like genre, Southern Gothic kind of goes in waves, and we're kind of in an uptick, I think, right now in interest in the genre or interest in just the Gothic in general, sort of, I think, on an uptick right now.
Yeah, that's a good
So
point.
that's another way to be like, well, if you like this, you know.
That makes sense. Do you have any special celebrations coming up for the centennial?
So one thing we haven't really talked about is that Flannery is also a painter. She did a lot of
Oh.
visual art. And this visual art is something that has not been seen by the public really since her death
Wow.
in 1964. It's coming back here, and all of it's going to be on display here at Andalusia.
Her as a painter too. I didn't know that. That is
Yeah,
cool. What? Yeah.
it's not as much as well known as her art or like her writing, obviously. So she did paint quite a bit. Actually, as a child, her first sort of dream career was being a cartoonist, like for the New Yorker. And she did a lot of her early publications are these sort of linoleum block print cartoons that she did for Georgia College and State University's newspaper, The Colonnade. So she does like little cartoons, sort of making fun of like the student, like kind of making fun of, like poking fun at the students. There was a lot of involvement in the Waves program, which was part of World War II. So she's like poking fun at the Waves. She's poking fun at just like being in college. And so that's where she gets her start. It's not later college. And also once she goes to Iowa, State University of Iowa, where she gets her master's degree. That she decides she kind of doesn't want to do that anymore. And once she starts really focusing on her fiction, she doesn't do as much visual art until about 1953, when she returns to sort of the more visual art with her self-portrait, which is probably her most famous piece of visual art, and then kind of keeps doing that as she goes. So mostly she used oil on canvas board. But her earlier pieces are actually done with wood. They're actually like wood carved, like they've
Oh,
burned.
wow.
They're burned, and then painted on top of. So they're pretty interesting.
Wow. That's a fascinating aspect of a cartoon drawing and writing too, because I feel like that's got to be a good way to hone your quick wit, you know, if you have a sentence or two for a caption.
Yeah, it's definitely where you can see like her humor is very intentional. It's like these sort of these humorous little bits. But yeah, she actually thought that a lot more authors should paint or like should do visual art because it forced them to like look at the world around her. And that's another thing is like a lot of her work is very grounded, even in the ways that it's sort of like satirical or exaggerated. It's very grounded. And she thought that like visual art, like there needed to be like an element of visual art that every author did to sort of focus them to look and to see and to think.
Yeah, that's I like that because that does to enhance your writing, have add a visual aspect that I'll have to think on that more. I like that a lot because that would I feel like that would help me too.
Yeah. And I mean, there are a lot of authors who do also do visual art. I know, was it Sylvia Plath did like collages? I think Faulkner did some, Hemingway did. So there is a lot of authors who are best known for their written work that did do some sort of visual art as well. It's just not as well known. And I know some, you know, authors like illustrate their own work. Like you know, A.A. Milne worked really closely with the illustrations for Winnie the Pooh. So
Yeah, they do go hand in hand. Yeah.
There's
Yeah.
they don't necessarily overlap. Like there are some artists that don't write and some writers that don't do art, but there is some overlap between the
Yeah.
two.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, I want to circle back on the religion aspect of O'Connor's life, because as you know, we're at the American Writers Museum working on our new exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, which is set to open in November of this year. And you will be generously loaning some items, some personal items from Flannery O'Connor's life. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, so we are loaning some like a holy water bottle and a rosary belonging to O'Connor. So those are both, very important vessels in the Catholic faith. She actually had they're on display in her house, the holy water bottles that have holy water from Lourdes, France, which is where she got on her pilgrimage. But of course the rosary is an important part of the, the Catholic faith and the, praying of the rosary and stuff. So we're really excited to be able to lend those to you to add another part to your exhibit.
Yes, yeah, we're excited to have them and yeah, further illuminate your work, O'Connor's life and writing, and especially about this topic. We look forward to that. November of this year is when it'll open, and yeah, we'll have programming throughout the year leading up to it, and then during the extent of the exhibit as well. So definitely check it out. And Cassie, as we're getting close to the end here, was there anything else about O'Connor or your work that we haven't touched on that you wanted to mention?
It's O'Connor is definitely really a really interesting person. I think a lot of people we get a lot of people who are like, oh, I read her in high school, but it's later that you can see sort of all the elements kind of lay up. I don't know if anyone loves, authors that were forced to read in high school.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely did, so maybe, but maybe I'm the exception.
Yeah, well, I did too, but yeah, that's how we
Look
end
where
up
we
in.
ended up,
Yeah,
right?
exactly. Yeah.
But her influence kind of shows up in a lot of places. You can't think about Southern Gothic or really a lot more American culture than you would think of without talking about her. So people like Bruce Springsteen, Martin Scorsese, U2, REM. And even sort of other or like literature gets compared to her a lot. I
Yeah.
literally was like picking up a book the other day. I was like at the library and I like turned over and it was like the TV show Supernatural meets Flannery O'Connor. And I was like, ah.
Funny.
So
Yeah.
she kind of she appears in a lot of ways. And so I think definitely read her work. It can be kind of challenging to get in. She was a little bit maybe experimental might be the wrong word, but like some of her work is a little bit like, it's not just like
It's
walk
not,
off the street. You got to think about
yeah,
it a little bit, but
yeah.
it's
It's not like,
it's
yeah.
really
So,
good once if you're willing to sort of like think about it.
yeah.
And I would encourage people, to come down. So we're in Milledgeville, Georgia. That is about 2 hours south of Atlanta or 2 hours north of Savannah, depending on what direction you're coming from. I can give you some estimates for other big cities, but I don't really know. I only really know the Georgia, or we're 3 hours from Mobile, Alabama.
All right, there you go.
but we are open Tuesday through Saturdays, 10 to 4, and Sundays, 2 to 4. Our tours are about an hour and last top of the hour. It's such a wonderful property. I really would recommend people coming. And Milledgeville is it's a small town, but it's a really nice town to come and visit and be in.
Yeah, it does. I've always wanted to go, honestly, to Andalusia because it's always looked,
Well, you
yeah.
should.
Beautiful, I know. Yeah, now I have an excuse. Well, thank you again, Cassie, for joining me on this. I had a blast chatting with you, and
Thank you for having me on.
yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.